Call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:23 p.m. and it's Friday, March 18, 2022. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Talia Ames from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. This time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Christ Tompkins on the teleconference line, my Vice Chair Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Clayman. We do not need a quorum to conduct business, the business that we have today. Our first and only order of business is House Bill 159, Consumer Data Privacy Act, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. This is the second hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Today we'll hear from Ryan Harkins, Senior Director of Public Policy at Microsoft, about privacy legislation broadly, as well as specific feedback on the proposed legislation, House Bill 159. Please identify yourself for the record, and then you may begin your remarks. And I would note that he is on Teams, and I'd note as well that Representative Eastman joined us at 1:24 p.m. Mr. Harkins.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As you said, my name is Ryan Harkins, and I'm with Microsoft, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I thought I would provide a bit of an overview of the history and current landscape relating to privacy and privacy legislation here in the United States, highlighting some trends that we've been seeing with legislative activity across the country. And then providing a bit of a discussion about some of the important and current issues that are currently being debated relating to privacy legislation. So this issue in particular is not new to our company. And Lizzie, can you advance to the next slide for me? Our mission at Microsoft is to empower every person and every organization on the planet to achieve more. And the way we are orienting ourselves around that mission today, next slide, please, is through AI. It is our company's aim to make AI available to every organization and every person on the planet. And in this context, by AI or artificial intelligence, we can think broadly about any sort of automated technology, online services, or software that assist people in making decisions or that otherwise perform functions or help people perform functions more effectively. Now, from a public policy point of view, you can think about AI as the confluence of three different trends or developments. The first is massive increases in processing power. So in the 1970s, computer scientists had created microprocessors that could process something on the order of over 90,000 instructions per second. And that sounds like a lot until you consider that today, each and every one of us is carrying a supercomputer or a smartphone in our pockets that are capable of processing billions of instructions per second. So the amount of processing power that we can bring to bear on any sort of problem is much, much greater than it was even 5 or 10 years ago. The second development is the creation of new and more sophisticated algorithms. And these are computer programs that, among other things, are much more adept at processing large volumes of even unstructured data and of identifying patterns and deriving inferences or conclusions from large sets of data. The third development is by far the most important, and that is data itself. And next slide, please. We are processing, creating, storing, and able to use much more data than we ever were before. And it is this last piece, data, that is the most important, because it is our ability to process and identify patterns from extremely large sets of data and to do so very quickly, which is leading to much of the innovation that we see today. So whether we are talking about programs that perform natural language translations or even basic programs like your spell checker, to our ability to sequence the human genome or even provide autonomous vehicles. More than anything else, it is our ability to use data that is incredibly important to that. And so that is sort of the lens through which our company comes at this issue. How can we create rules of the road that will apply rules and regulations to industry's ability to create and use data and to do so in ways that provide real protections for consumers while also allowing industry to continue to innovate responsibly? And next slide, please. And this is a big challenge. And it is a challenge because the creation of large sets of data and our ability to process large sets of data pose very obvious difficulties when it comes to personal privacy. Next slide, please. And this is something that we have been very concerned about at Microsoft for over two decades. About 20 years ago, Bill Gates wrote something that at the company is referred to as the Trustworthy Computing Memo. And this memo portended the rise of much of the commercial internet that we see today and predicted that as more and more online services and software moved online, moved to what we now refer to as the cloud, that gaining the trust of consumers and customers would be incredibly important to make that ecosystem work. And that two issues above all else would be paramount to gaining and earning that trust: security and privacy. And it has long been our belief that, particularly as we've seen concerns about consumer privacy rise over the years, as we've seen growing distrust in technology and the technology industry, it is our view that we need the passage of new laws, laws that will provide credible privacy protections for consumers, in order to start to earn that trust back. And to some extent, this phenomenon isn't really all that new. I mean, you can go back, next slide, please. 130 years ago to 1890, when one of the most famous law review articles of all time was written by Samuel Warren and the future Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, The Right to Privacy. And this article really serves as the foundation for more than 100 years of development of privacy law in this country and arguably around the world. And Warren and Brandeis were responding at the time.
We're going to take a very, very short pause to recognize that Representative Drummond joined us at 1:30 p.m. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Warren and Brandeis were responding at the time to what they viewed as the development of new and increasingly invasive technologies and new business models. Now, they were referring to the rise of instantaneous photography, as well as listening devices or bugs, both of which could be used to either record conversations or take pictures of people in their personal lives and to make that information more broadly available to others. That, in combination with the rise of yellow journalism or the gossip rags, led them to write this article in which they argued that the American common law ought to recognize essentially a new tort, and that is the tort of the right to privacy, a right which they described as the right to be let alone. Next slide. If you fast forward 70 years, very famous torts professor William Prosser wrote another famous law review article, which summarized the development of case law after Warren Brandeis's article over the course of 70 years and organized the case law into four distinct privacy torts. And those, even still today, are primarily the four privacy torts that we know of in the United States. Next slide. But if you, both of those developments really occur well before the rise of new computer technology and certainly before the internet. And if you fast forward again into the 70s, you find a committee that was, or a report that was created by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare in Washington, D.C. And this was a report that was intended to address growing concerns about the use of databases or computers to collect and store information about individuals. And there were concerns even then about the impact that may have on personal privacy. And this report produced a set of principles, what we now refer to as fair information principles or practices, which were intended to govern and provide individuals with certain rights with respect to the collection and use of information about them by databases. Now, this report and the principles in this report ultimately serve as the basis for another set of principles that the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, released in 1980. And those principles, which have been amended over time, ultimately serve as the basis for the first comprehensive privacy law that passed in the European Union, something which I'll touch upon in just a bit. But notwithstanding the fact that it was in the United States, really, where we first developed what we now refer to as fair information practices, we, for decades in the United States, did not pass a comprehensive privacy law. Meaning we did not, and you can move on to the next slide, we did not have and have not had a comprehensive law that would address and apply to privacy issues across industries and across subject matters. So instead, we have had certain narrow industry-specific privacy laws or privacy laws that address narrow issues. So for example, we have HIPAA and the High-Tech Act, which addresses privacy in healthcare. We have the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which to some extent addresses privacy in the financial industry. We have something called the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA, which applies to the collection of personal information from kids under 13 online. Now, undergirding that, we have had consumer protection laws like the Federal Trade Commission Act, Section 5, or various state UDAP or consumer protection laws, which bar unfair deceptive trade practices and have been applied to some privacy issues. But besides that, we really have not had a comprehensive or omnibus approach to privacy. And that is in direct contrast, next slide, please, to the approach that the Europeans have taken. So in 1995, the European Union passed something called the Data Protection Directive. And this was essentially an omnibus or comprehensive privacy law. So taking those fair information practices I referred to, in particular those that were developed by the OECD, and using them to develop a comprehensive data protection regulatory regime that would apply to privacy issues across industries. And it is this law, the Data Protection Directive, next slide please, which the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, essentially updated.
Mr. Harkins?
Yeah.
Are you comfortable taking questions as we go, or do you want to finish the presentation and then take questions?
I'm happy to, either way, Mr. Chair, whatever works for you.
We'll hold. You've got about 10 minutes or so left, or
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, let's go ahead and finish the presentation, then we'll go to questions.
Very good. Thank you. So the GDPR in many ways has become the global gold standard for data protection laws. And we have seen an increasing number of countries around the world adopting their own comprehensive privacy laws, most of which are fundamentally based upon the approach taken by the GDPR. But in the United States, of course, until recently, we still, and you can flip ahead two slides, Lizzie, thank you. We have not had a comprehensive privacy law, and it's not for a lack of trying. We at Microsoft have been calling for a comprehensive privacy law in Washington, D.C. since 2005. And 17 years later, we're still waiting for Congress to pass a law like that. But while Congress has been unable to act, next slide, the states, the laboratories of democracy, if you will, have been acting. And California was the first to do so. So back in 2017, next slide, please, a real estate developer named Alistair McTaggart III became increasingly concerned about the issue of online privacy. And he pulled together a small team. They wrote a ballot initiative. They proceeded to collect signatures and qualified that initiative for the ballot. And that initiative ultimately created the pressure to pass in 2018, next slide, please, the country's first comprehensive privacy law, the first comprehensive privacy law in the United States. And that was a significant achievement. We were very supportive of passing CCPA and tried to work behind the scenes to help it advance. We certainly by no means think that California's law is perfect, but it was significant because it was the first one. And immediately thereafter, we saw a wave of privacy bills introduced in legislatures across the country. So next slide, please. The following year, for instance, in our home state of Washington, Senator Reuven Carlisle introduced a bill, the Washington Privacy Act, which at the time was an effort to go further than California went and provide consumers in Washington state with additional rights and protections that California law at the time did not, but to do so in a way that used terminology and concepts from the European Union's GDPR, concepts which, some of which in our view, are a bit clearer, and or concepts that if you're a business that does business outside of this country, you already have some familiarity with. That bill, next slide, please. Although after four sessions of trying, that bill was never actually adopted by the legislature, although the House and Senate in Washington state each passed similar versions. That bill did help add to the growing wave of privacy legislation across the country. And in March of 2021, just last year, the state of Virginia became the second state in the country to pass a comprehensive privacy law, a law that is fundamentally based upon the Washington Privacy Act. And a few months later, the state of Colorado followed up by also passing a privacy law that bears a lot of similarities to the Washington Privacy Act, and a law that in some significant ways and important ways is stronger than Virginia's. Just this year, we've seen the legislature in the state of Utah pass a law which is purported to be based upon the Washington Privacy Act, although we have real concerns about the law or the bill. And whether it would actually provide real protections to consumers. And I can talk about some of those concerns in a bit. But there does continue to be, next slide, please, a lot of activity in states across the country. This year alone, we've been tracking about 70 comprehensive privacy bills across at least 30 states. And there are a number of states that have come close to passing privacy laws or have at least advanced privacy legislation. And these include states from across the country and across the political spectrum. So in the state of Ohio, in the state of Oklahoma, and the state of Florida, for instance, there have been serious efforts to pass comprehensive privacy legislation. There has also been serious efforts in the state of New York and the state of Connecticut, among other places. In our view, any privacy law, in order to be credible, has to do, next slide, please, a number of things. One is that it has to provide for strong corporate responsibility or accountability. And that means, among other things, that it has to impose affirmative obligations on companies to steward the data that they collect responsibly, irrespective of whether a consumer has decided to exercise a right. And there are a number of ways to articulate those sorts of affirmative obligations, but at minimum, they should include things like obligations to conduct data protection impact assessments, or a requirement to evaluate your processing activities and weigh the benefits of processing data against the risks of harm to consumers. They have to include a core set of consumer rights. These are rights that are necessary to enable consumers to control their personal information. They would include things like the right of access, the right to transparency, the right to delete, the right to correct inaccuracies in their personal data. We think it ought to include a right to port personal data from one service provider to another. And then, frankly, there needs to be some consent rights around certain activities that pose a heightened risk of harm to consumers. We think, in addition to there needing to be transparency obligations, there also has to be strong enforcement. And next slide, please. It really, more than anything else, the issue of enforcement has proven to be, I think, the most challenging issue to getting privacy legislation passed. And specifically, the question there is whether a privacy bill should include a private right of action or not. The laws passed in Colorado and Virginia do not contain private rights of action. They provide for enforcement solely by the Attorney General. The law in California, California's law, the CCPA, was updated by a ballot initiative passed in November 2020, the California Privacy Rights Act. That law provides for enforcement now not only by the Attorney General, but by a new data protection agency that is a state agency that has been created. California also provides for a limited private right of action for certain data breaches that result from negligent security practices. But this conversation has been a difficult one to have because many in the business community remain opposed to anything that might be redolent of allowing consumers to seek some sort of relief in court. And there are other stakeholders who believe that there ought to be a broad class action liability with statutory damages appended to any violation of a privacy law. And in reality, there are a private right of action is not black and white. It's not all or nothing. And there are a lot of different things that policymakers could consider to provide consumers with the ability to enforce their rights, for example. Things like the ability to seek injunctive relief and perhaps attorney's fees, perhaps even actual damages for violations of the consumer rights. while not opening up private rights of action to, say, failing to dot the right I or cross the right T in your privacy policy. There are a number of other key issues that continue to be important. One is the privacy law going to cover modern data sets and the way data is collected online and the way it is used to track consumers online today? Any privacy law to be credible has to apply not only to identified data, any data that is associated, for example, with my name, Ryan Harkins, but to identifiable data, meaning data that is associated not with my name, but perhaps with a cookie ID or an IP address or a device ID or some other form of persistent unique identifier, because it is those types of data sets that are used to track consumers online today in order to do things like serve them with targeted advertising. So is the bill going to cover those sort of modern online data sets? And as a sub issue to that, and something which I'll just mention briefly, but I'd be happy to answer questions about, we've seen some controversy about the inclusion of a term called pseudonymous data in some privacy bills. And that is a term that, frankly, my recommendation would be to leave it out of a privacy bill. The bill that you have had before your committee does not include it, which I think is a good thing. And that is because that term is confusing to understand and, in our view, is prone to abuse and could be applied by some in industry to argue that those sorts of modern online data sets are somehow not subject to some of the consumer rights. There are a number of other issues that continue to be important. One relates to the set of consumer rights that a bill will have. And even if a privacy bill or a privacy law appears to contain all of the rights you would want to provide a consumer, there still are issues, important issues, around whether the rights are broad enough to allow consumers to actually control their personal information. And an example is the right to delete. So the law in California, Virginia, and Colorado all provide consumers with the right to delete the personal data. But the law in California only applies to personal information collected from a consumer, which means that it leaves two important categories out. It would not arguably apply to data that a company obtains from a third-party source, like a data broker, nor would it arguably apply to personal data that a company has inferred or derived from other data. And by and large, if you're talking about targeted advertising profiles, those profiles are not necessarily going to contain a consumer's raw web browsing data. They are going to contain inferences that are derived from that data. So say, let's say I'm user 12345, or at least my data is stored with a cookie ID of that sort. You could say this is a white male in his mid-40s, lives in Seattle, likes the Seahawks, has kids, is of a particular political persuasion, etc. And those inferences are what are really interesting. There are other issues around, consumer rights. So the Utah bill that just passed the Utah legislature, for example, does not give consumers a right to correct inaccuracies in their personal data. It's a right that was also missing from the latest version of the bill. It was before your committee. It's a right that we would suggest that you consider adding. There are issues around what is the role that consent ought to play in a privacy bill. We recommend, for example, that in order to process sensitive data, so think data like geolocation information, biometric information, or other types of sensitive data sets, that opt-in consent ought to be required in order to process that type of data. That is something that the GDPR provides for. It's something that the law in Colorado provides for. And it's in contrast, frankly, to the California law, which only requires notice and the right to opt out of the processing of sensitive data. But then there are also concerns around how do you define the set of activities that, in your view, pose heightened privacy risks to consumers? And once you have defined those appropriately, are you providing consumers with some ability to exercise choice or consent with respect to those activities? And I think if I was to provide a bit of feedback about the bill before your committee, which really emphasizes providing an opt-out right to the exchange or sale of data, something which is important, I think it may miss the mark because in addition to the sale of data or the exchange of data, we'd encourage policymakers to think about the profiling of individuals online for purposes like targeted advertising or even for important decisions like whether to provide someone with insurance, credit, housing, etc. And are you providing consumers with the ability to have some choice about whether they are subjected to that type of profiling, irrespective of whether those profiles are created by exchanging information with third parties or whether they're created solely by an extremely large platform from data processing and activities on the platform? And if you're only applying consent rights to the exchange of information with third parties and not to that other category, you may unintentionally be providing and solidifying a competitive advantage for in particular, the two largest advertising platforms on the planet.
Okay. So what I wanted there, to actually, let's take a pause there for questions. I know from your PowerPoints, that was kind of the broad overview before we get into the bill. And I actually know we've got one representative that may be leaving soon. So, and I've got her in the queue for some questions. So we'll take some questions from committee members. And then after we get through those questions, we can then turn to some of the discussion about the specifics you got in your PowerPoint about House Bill 159. Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Mr. Harkins, for that overview. I'm curious for my own education, just understanding the different considerations and contexts that go into creating these pieces of privacy legislation. From my world of natural and social science research, I'm familiar with the 1974 National Research Act, which created the Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects and Biomedical and Behavioral Research, and it provides the development of very detailed guidelines for the ethical conduct of research, including research on human behavior. And it strikes me that when we're talking about the data that are being collected here, whether it's being used for artificial intelligence development or to predict consumer behaviors or travel patterns or groups that others may associate with and using that information to whatever end, that is collecting data for analyzing human behavior. And within this world, with the creation of IRB, so institutional review boards for other entities that conduct this type of research, there are very strict and detailed and well-established rules for protecting privacy and providing guidelines for participant approval, essentially, to participate in that research. And I'm curious if that act and all of the things that came out of that act and have directed behavioral research in the decades since that act went into effect, has any of that information and legislation and guidance been used to inform privacy legislation? I'm just curious of the overlap or intersection. And if not, if you know, why not?
Well, I do think that those sorts of ethical concerns continue to be very relevant, in particular to permitting the use of data for public research or research in furtherance of the public interest, which a number of privacy laws that have passed in other privacy bills have attempted to address. You know, how do we ensure that privacy can, notwithstanding the obligations that are and rights that are being included in a consumer privacy bill, can we carve out or ensure that data can still be used for, say, public research and the like, as long as it is consistent with ethical considerations and other sorts of rules and norms that would otherwise apply in kind of the traditional institutional setting. Beyond that, I'm not sure I can comment as to what extent the underlying rules in those sorts of laws have really informed the debate about consumer privacy laws. I think though that conversation has really been driven by initially the set of fair information practices that the OECD developed in 1980, and then, to be honest, really by the European Union. The European Union, as I mentioned, with the passage of the Data Protection Directive in 1995 and now the GDPR, is viewed as a leader around the world in this space. And it's that framework or that model that continues to be the primary driver of these discussions around the world. And to some extent, it influences the discussions here in the United States, although the approaches taken by California, Colorado, and Virginia in some respects are fundamentally different than, say, the GDPR.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? I have a couple of questions. It sounds like on an international level, the GDPR is, from what you've described it, is the gold standard. What's your perspective on why the states that have taken up the data privacy work have chosen not to be more aligned with the GDPR?
Well, fundamentally, the GDPR just has a very different orientation fundamentally. So in Europe under the GDPR, and this was true under the Data Protection Directive as well, the baseline assumption is that you cannot process personal data unless you can demonstrate a good reason for doing so. So under the GDPR, if a company, or as they would refer to it, a controller, wants to collect and use or share personal data, they have to establish a lawful basis for processing data. And there are a number of lawful bases outlined in the law itself, one of which is consent, but there are others like legitimate interests. So the Europeans have a legitimate interest test to determine whether you have a lawful basis for processing data. And it requires essentially a balancing of the benefits of processing data against the risks of harm to consumers. So that kind of orientation or approach just seems to be foreign or alien to most U.S. audiences. And in particular here in the United States, where traditionally the baseline assumption has been you can process data unless you're told you cannot. So that is the biggest difference in terms of the approaches that the various laws in the U.S. take compared to GDPR. In other respects, there are similarities. So the GDPR, for example, distinguishes between the entities that are subject to the law and what their obligations are to comply with the law. They apply to controllers, which are the entities that determine the purposes and means of processing data. They're the ones that call the shots about what's being done with data. They'll tend to have the direct relationship with consumers, as opposed to processors, who provide services only to controllers or process data only pursuant to binding contracts and pursuant to binding instructions provided by controllers. And the laws in Colorado and Virginia also adopt that controller processor construct. The law in California doesn't expressly use those terms. It uses the term business and service provider, and its approach is a bit different, but by and large, I think it lands on it at a very similar place. There are other similarities that you can point to with respect to the different laws. Some of the consumer rights are the same, although the GDPR has its consent right, at least aside from the fact it requires opt-in consent for sensitive data. They call a right to object. It's somewhat akin to the right to opt out of processing that you see, or the right to opt out of sale that you see in California, Colorado, Virginia, et cetera. And, you know, the other thing that is really different about the GDPR is, and the Data Protection Directive before that, is that each member state in the European Union has its own agency, a data protection agency, which is responsible for implementing and enforcing data protection law in that country. Now, California has followed suit now by adopting the CPRA and creating its own data protection agency. But creating new agencies costs money and, you know, it's a big effort. And for whatever reason, I think, in part due to those concerns, we've seen other states like in Colorado and Virginia decline to do that, and instead to continue leaning on their attorney general's office to enforce the law and, in some instances, like in Colorado, create regulations under the law.
What is the does the GDPR in Europe have a private right of action provision, or is that whole topic of a private right of action probably a more American concept?
It really is more of an American concept. I mean, there is individuals do have the ability to file suit or under data protection law in the European Union. But the rules and norms around your ability to do that are different than they are in Europe, or different in Europe than they are in the United States. And in Europe, they don't have anything like the class action bar or the same degree of class action suits and class action liability that businesses face here in the United States.
Other questions? Representative Christ Tompkins, I know you're on the line. If you have questions, you should speak up. Doesn't sound like he does. Representative Eastman. Oh, Representative Christ Tompkins?
Sorry, just coming off. No, no, I'm good, but thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Can you please describe how the bill achieves its jurisdiction, shall we say? How do we apply this to, you know, some businesses, not other businesses, and so forth? What is it that makes the bill apply to, what is the scope of the bill in terms of who it applies to and who it doesn't apply to?
Are we talking about the Alaska bill or the other bills in the other states that he's
in? This case, I'm specifically talking about House Bill 159.
Well, most bills like the Alaska bill, and I'm blanking offhand on what the actual thresholds are, but most, like in California, Colorado, Virginia, for example, they apply a test that is really intended to ensure that the law will apply to companies of a certain size or that are processing data on a certain number of consumers, and companies that may be processing the personal data of a lower number of consumers, but that are also engaged in activities that are viewed as more sensitive from a privacy point of view. And the overarching goal there has been to ensure that the bill is not unduly burdening small businesses, say your mom and pop pizza shop or the dry cleaner down the street or the local coffee shop. I'm not sure that any state has really offered a silver bullet as far as what the appropriate thresholds ought to be to ensure you are truly covering both businesses that process lots of data and smaller businesses that, say, are processing some data but are also, say, getting a lot of their revenue from selling data and that sort of thing. The idea there being that you not only want to cover, say, the Microsofts of the world, but, you know, a company like Cambridge Analytica was a small business, although they had data on lots of people and were arguably engaged in very privacy-sensitive activities. So, you know, I'm happy to discuss various considerations that you might think about in trying to thread that needle. You know, California, for example, has, I can't remember offhand what their thresholds are, but would perhaps apply the law to businesses that process personal information on if it's 100,000 or 50,000 consumers in California, as well as businesses that process data of a lower number of consumers, but then also derive a certain percentage of their revenue from selling data.
Paul, Representative Eastman, and just for my own clarity, this may be my confusion, I've got in my notebook a summary of the act, but that must have been a prior presentation and not your presentation. We've seen all the slides at this point. Okay. I was mistaken for those that were thinking to talk about a second presentation. There isn't a second presentation. Representative, go ahead.
Thank you. Also through the chair. All right. So let's pare that down a little bit. So we have a definition of business in the statute before us that does not include nonprofits. And I'm just curious, what about consumer protections for the nonprofit organizations that are going to be involved in, you know, collecting, sharing, selling, buying this data?
Well, I can say that there certainly are nonprofits that process large volumes of data and that otherwise would fall under the definition of whether it's a business. And I've pulled up the provision now. I can see that business under the bill you have before you would apply to someone who processes personal information of 100,000 or more consumers or households or derives 50% or more of its annual revenue from selling or sharing personal information. You know, Microsoft, you might be surprised to find, is not a nonprofit. And so we clearly would be covered, as we should be, by this bill. I think that is a policy decision that I would say you as lawmakers need to make. And that is whether you want to a privacy law like this to apply to nonprofits who would otherwise qualify as businesses under the law. Certainly the many of the privacy risks that stem from data processing activities that for-profit institutions engage in would arguably also be present with respect to nonprofits.
Paul, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And yes, so Microsoft clearly, you know, fits the definition of a corporation with shareholders and whatnot, which is articulated in the language here. That said, what can you summarize for us? What is driving Microsoft support for this legislation or legislation of this type? What is the main or what are the major benefits to Microsoft should this bill pass?
Or assuming,
We think so. I mean, as I mentioned, we've been calling for comprehensive privacy legislation since 2005. And the fundamental reason is we see and have seen growing distrust across the country and around the world from consumers, from customers and others about the use of technology to collect information about each and every one of us. And in our view, if we don't address those concerns, and specifically, if we don't address those concerns by passing new laws, those concerns could lead people to not use technology. It could lead people to call for rules that might prohibit us from using data in responsible ways to innovate and provide the kinds of products and services that our customers and that consumers want. And so in our view, it is in our interest, it's in the industry's interest long term, it's in the public's interest and consumers' interest to create clear rules of the road and regulate industry's collection, use, and sharing of personal data so that we actually provide consumers with real protections and allow industry to continue to innovate responsibly.
Thank you. Paula?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. now, I can imagine that passage of this bill might be greeted with, you know, support from the public looking for consumer protection, but I mean, how many Alaskans are really going to be protected by this if their data is, you know, existing in the cloud and not really, let's just say you have businesses that don't normally have any kind of footprint in Alaska. How does this statute, if it passes, how does it protect Alaskans, you know, for businesses that never decide to, you know, quote unquote, do traditional business in our state?
Well, if they're processing the personal data of Alaska consumers, then they would have to comply with the law, and they should, in our view. I mean, today, there isn't a comprehensive consumer privacy law that protects Alaska consumers today, unless you know, were to count, say, Alaska's Consumer Protection Act, or perhaps, you know, privacy protections in the Alaska State Constitution. But Alaska consumers, as most consumers are across the country, with the exception of consumers in California, and when they become effective, the laws in Virginia and Colorado, when they become effective, consumers in those states, otherwise, most consumers across the country are unprotected today.
And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
So if you have a company in Florida selling data to a company in Illinois, which, you know, includes some number of Alaskans' data, how does Alaska, as a legislature, how do we find or claim jurisdiction to, you know, stop or prevent or regulate that transaction between companies in other states that, in this scenario, never do business in Alaska?
Well, I would argue if they are collecting personal information of Alaska consumers online, they are doing business in Alaska. And that, in our view, would be the jurisdictional hook. If you're collecting personal information of Alaska consumers, that is sufficient or should be sufficient to provide for coverage under an Alaska law.
Paula?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So let's just say that we could impact the collection of data, and that at some point, you know, that data was housed in Alaska and then collected. What about once that first company sells it to another company? Can we legally regulate the transaction, you know, between a second, a third, a fourth, and a fifth company trading that information? Is there still a way that we can say, well, that, you know, deals with Alaska residents, so we can regulate that activity?
Yes, I think as long as you're talking about companies that are collecting or processing the personal information of Alaska consumers, then in our view, in my view, Alaska can pass a law to regulate that activity.
Thank you.
I had a question about the private rights of action. You talk about different ways to approach it, and I recognize one of the topics about enforcement is that if you don't have the private right of action, then you kind of need to have a meaningful presence in the Attorney General's office to be enforcing it on behalf of citizens, or you have a private right of action that gives the citizens the ability to do that to the extent the Attorney General's office lacks resources or lacks time, or they may not choose it's worth enforcing. How have different states, I know there's only three, but well, I guess only three have passed laws, but how are the different states that have legislation, how are they looking at the different ways of a private right of action or not? And I guess if you don't have it, you simply don't have it. But are there some hybrid in-betweens that give some private rights of action but also doesn't make it unfettered, if you will?
Well, while California is, as you alluded to, Mr. Chair, the only state to have any form of private right of action in a comprehensive privacy law, and California's privacy law would permit consumers to sue for certain data breaches that result from negligent security practices. There have been lots of conversations, whether it's in Washington State, in Florida, in Ohio, in New York, in Oklahoma, among other places, about how you could craft a private right of action. And I think some of the things to think about are whether, for example, you can provide consumers with the ability to, say, seek injunctive relief. So to go to court and file a lawsuit to ensure that their rights are carried out. Say, hey, I went to Microsoft. I asked Microsoft to delete my data. They didn't do it. I would like a court order directing Microsoft to delete my data. You could couple that with, you know, other things to consider would be the ability to seek attorney's fees if you succeed in that suit. I think, you know, much of the consternation we hear across industry relating to private rights of action relates to the risk that you could have statutory damages that would permit really large damage awards for violations of privacy laws where no actual harm occurred or was caused to consumers. And so if you're concerned about ensuring that businesses aren't subject to those types of risks, you can think about, well, maybe you grant the ability to seek relief or file a lawsuit to seek actual damages that were caused by a violation of the consumer rights or something like that. Another issue to think about, and this has come up primarily in say, California and in Washington State this last session, where the legislature was considering, among other things, the creation of a data privacy commission in Washington State, but that is whether there is some opening to have a state agency or some sort of administrative enforcement of a law, allowing people or perhaps an agency to conduct administrative hearings, and perhaps that is a way to allow some form of private relief without incurring all of the expenses of filing an actual lawsuit in court.
Thank you. I've got a question from Representative Eastman. Please.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, the bill before us talks about a 3% tax on revenue from selling or sharing data. The selling part, I think I can understand. I mean, there's usually a dollar amount goes along when we sell something, but when you share something, I'm not quite sure. 3% of what? Is there any explanation you can offer in terms of why sharing would be included in the type of behavior that's being taxed here?
Well, I think trying to tax transactions like that poses a whole separate set of concerns. I think you're alluding to perhaps some of the challenges around how you would evaluate what is subject to a tax and, you know, what would the amount of the tax be, or what are you deriving the percentage from, et cetera. But more broadly, if you table the issues about taxation, you know, the bill currently devises the opt-out right around sharing, selling, and the disclosure of information. And the way it is architected, it may be both too broad and too narrow at the same time. And that is because the bill, for example, appropriately defines personal information broad enough so that it would cover online data sets and even the basic information that your computer sends to a website anytime you try to go online and access the website. You know, it will send, in addition to cookies that may be applicable to that domain on your machine, you know, your IP address, your version of operating system, and various other pieces of information, which are personal information under the bill. If you then provide people with a right to opt out of the disclosure of that information, you may be pulling in or implicating any time you were to click to another website off of an initial website. And so the question is, do you really want to pull in basic information that is just necessary to make the internet work into those sort of consent rights? In particular, if that information is not actually being used to profile consumers. In addition, you know, even similar to the way California addresses cross-context behavioral advertising or targeted advertising, this bill would provide a right to opt out of the sharing of personal information for purposes of cross-context behavioral advertising. And sharing between third parties is one way that information can be collected for purposes of cross-context behavioral advertising. But arguably, that type of data collection and analysis can also happen directly by, say, a first party without actually exchanging data between third parties. And so if you are only covering the collection of data on a third party basis and not the collection of data on a first party basis for those purposes, you may unintentionally be not only leaving out that broad category, but creating a competitive advantage for the largest platforms on the internet, which can arguably collect and process all the information they need to profile consumers without actually exchanging the data with any third party.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Drummond, any questions?
I'm good right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I've got another one.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And if you could just help us understand, to what extent is this bill substantially different than, you know, some of the bills passed in other states that you're aware of? And I'm particularly thinking of the role of the Attorney General in this legislation, because it seems to empower the Attorney General to fill in sort of large gaps in the statute using regulation. And I think there may be a concern, since we don't have an elected Attorney General in Alaska, that, you know, we're basically giving an appointed individual the ability to effectively write law.
Well, in Virginia, for instance, the Attorney General does not have rulemaking authority under the Virginia law, I don't believe. But in both Colorado and California, the Attorney General does have rulemaking authority. Now, the rulemaking authority in California is set to transfer from the Attorney General to the new Data Protection Agency that the CPRA created. But we have seen in those laws anyway, an effort to provide the Attorney General with some rulemaking authority. And that is an effort to address one of the longstanding challenges to laws that attempt to regulate technology. And that is, as soon as they pass, they can ossify fairly quickly. And as technology continues to develop and advance, the law may fall behind. So, you know, one argument anyway in favor of rulemaking authority is to allow a regulatory body like an attorney general or some other agency to keep up with the pace of technological change by issuing rules. Now, you may, you know, those other states I mentioned, Colorado and California, both have elected attorneys general. I don't know whether that changes the calculus about whether you think that's a good idea or not. And you may want to, I could understand arguments in favor of limiting the rulemaking authority that an entity like that or an official like that may have to certain discrete areas of the law, particularly areas where you think it might be necessary to have more flexibility to keep up with technological change.
Thank you.
I suppose at some level in a attorney general's office that seems like they're having a hard time hiring attorneys and keeping their staff full in both the criminal and civil division. I know that's not really part of this bill, but to the extent we're having difficulty filling all the positions, the notion of creating additional duties on the attorney general and hiring more folks to do the job would be an additional challenge and one of the reasons to think about a private right of action. What about in I know in federal law, the so-called key TAM suits, that where the attorney general has to get notice and has to make a decision whether or not to file suit, so that for a citizen to bring a private right of action, they first have to notify the attorney general of that private right of action, that if the AG doesn't pick it up, that the citizen will then file suit at some point thereafter. Are any of the states looking at anything like that in terms of private rights of action?
We have seen proposals akin to that discussed in other states. In Washington State, for example, this last session, the legislature was discussing various proposals that would have perhaps allowed consumers to bring suit after a proceeding was completed through what would have been a new data protection or data privacy commission. And if that commission determined that the consumer suffered actual harm from the conduct at issue. But we haven't seen anything like that actually pass into law.
Well, I don't see any other questions, and I think that probably is a pretty full amount, pretty large amount of information. It's a lot to contemplate, and it reflects, I think, some of the complexity of the legislation. We are going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Monday, March 21st at 1 p.m. I would anticipate we've got a presentation about the governor's lawsuit with the doctors at API and issues relating to that suit, more informational, but we've got a professor a law professor that's going to provide us some background and information on those lawsuits. Separately, if anyone is considering offering an amendment to House Bill 17, please let our office know and submit them electronically by 5 p.m. on Friday, March 25th. Again, deadline for House Bill 17 amendments is Friday, March 25th. With that, we will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:32 p.m.